The following program is intended for blind and print-impaired listeners, and it is a production of the North Carolina Reading Service. And it's the Indie Week, Independent, and it's read by John Federson. And this broadcast, initial broadcast of this podcast, is dated June the 28th of 2024. We'll move into our Durham article first, following a budget win. The Durham Association of Educators gears up for a fight for a meet and confer policy. The mass of red shirt wearers inside the Durham County Meeting Hall was abuzz with excitement. Simone Kidu, president of the Durham Association of Educators, the DAE, Teachers Union, ushered members into the long wooden pews that faced the front of the hall, where county staff and the Board of Commissioners waited to deliberate over the 24-25 fiscal year budget one final time. The commissioners were expected to vote that evening, June the 10th, in favor of the school board's historic $27 million ask for local funding, after the county finance director, Keith Lane, had laid out the math for how to fully fund the board's request during a budget hearing. But Kidu had been in this fight long enough to know not to let her guard down. She held a modest smile as the meeting proceeded. Even if she and her allies scored a big win after a long, drawn-out battle, another struggle with the district was already underway. The DAE was going to the mat with the school board over a meet-and-confer policy, which would create a framework for the union to engage more meaningfully with the Durham Public Schools, DPS, administrators, and give a voice to worker concerns. And Kidu says of the goal, it's recognizing the union does not disrespect the workers that have not joined the union yet. Rather, it affirms workers' rights and shows all workers that the district respects our right to organize. 6 months earlier, that payroll crisis, which we've reported often, set off a firestorm throughout DPS. The DAE capitalized on the moment, organizing educators from across the district to push the school board and county commissioners for stronger communication and better resources. Union membership grew exponentially. Now, DAE wants a seat at the table to ensure that its members are adequately represented in future negotiations and to prevent further deteriorations of trust between educators, school board, and county leadership. But as negotiations have stalled, the union continues to apply pressure to get a policy on the books. In January, turmoil ripped through the local education community after DPS administrators determined the district could not afford the pay raises it had allocated last fall. Realizing its mistake, the district tried to rescind the raises. More than 1,300 classified workers, nurses, cafeteria workers, instructional assistants, maintenance staff, and others were affected. Frustration over the mishandling of the issue, which the school board and administrators were addressing mostly in closed session, led to weeks of sick outs, where teachers and other employees called out of work in protest, spending days marching through Durham streets and holding rallies with hundreds of community members. Ultimately, the district's chief financial officer, Paul Lesueur, and Superintendent Pascal Mubenga resigned over the scandal. Carlos Perez, a Jordan High School history teacher and member of DAA, says there was obviously a lot of frustration, anger, and a sense that things are getting worse or things are not going to change. As funding for North Carolina public schools has dwindled over the last decade, teachers are asked to do more with less, leading to burnout. DPS teacher attrition rate is up from 8.3% in 2021 to 12.9% in 2023, according to Public Instruction Department. Supplemental positions like instructional assistants and exceptional children educators have also been cut, placing a heavier burden on remaining school staff. Educators and staff felt their voices were unheard, their demands unmet, and DAE took the opportunity to bring those workers together under the banner of the union. Perez says, "The pay debacle was a spark or catalyst, but by the time that popped off, we had already generated a petition with clear demands that came out of talking to workers across the district about what their real needs are. We had already been scaling up the union." DAE members deployed various tactics, taking days off work to talk to colleagues at other schools, waking up early to visit school bus lots, tabling before and after school to talk to people as they came and went, all in the service of building up union membership. And Perez says, "That's what made us prepared to seize the moment in the way we did, but also part of what allowed us to position ourselves is a widespread recognition that public education is under attack and in a state of crisis. Anyone who's worked a day in public schools, either here in Durham or elsewhere, knows that." DAE now had ample leverage to organize members in service of its cause. Perez says there was a sense of hope and solidarity and inspiration that people were on the move and on the move for each other. And that was palpable, definitely in my building. Elevating workers' voices is a major selling point for DAE. Employees, especially classified staff, have found a vehicle for their frustrations. Quentin Hedden, an instructional assistant at Riverside High School, quickly became a fixture at DAE rallies after he was recruited last year and spoke on behalf of the many classified staff members who he says are overworked, underpaid, and underappreciated. Quote, "If you mess with the classified staff, you mess with the 90th percentile of your school. We wanted a seat at the table. That message has now changed. We demand a seat at the table." Hedden and others have become leaders at their schools and in their community after joining DAE's ranks. Should another issue like the payroll crisis arise in the future, says Perez, more folks will have the muscle memory to act with confidence. Quote, "Look at the number of people who have stepped up across the district in every school, every job category, whether it's cafeteria workers, janitors, exceptional children, instructional assistants, teachers," says Perez, who has been a DAE member since he moved to Durham in 2017. "I've never seen this scale of activity or this level of participation and involvement in the union. It's a beautiful thing to see." Membership in the North Carolina Association of Educators, NCAE, the statewide parent organization of DAE, stalled in the mid-2010s after Republicans gained power in the state legislature and changed how the organization was allowed to operate. North Carolina is a right-to-work state, making union membership across industries some of the lowest in the country. Toward the end of the decade, a new class of NCAE leaders rejuvenated the organization's membership and fundraising efforts and bolstered the foundations of its local chapters. Momentum was already on DAE's side when the union voted to elect its new president, Kiju, in the summer of 2023, leading the charge towards the union's efforts to secure adequate pay and other worker rights. Kiju, a Durham native and a graduate of Jordan High School, knows the district intimately. She began working as a DPS school social worker in 2015, helping families access the resources they needed to succeed in the school system. Not long after she started, Donald Trump was elected president, and state Republicans continued to dry up resources for public schools. That put a particular strain on Latin American families in the district, Kiju says. Quote, "I was now facing this very real issue of kids' fears of their parents being deported. I can teach them about coping skills for anxiety, but that's a legitimate fear. I can't cognitive behavioral therapy their way out of that fear when the president-elect gets on the news and says he wants to deport their parents. In 2016, Wildin Acosta, a Riverside High student, was facing deportation 2 years after fleeing to the United States to avoid gang violence in Honduras. Members of the community, including folks from DAE, worked diligently to keep Acosta in Durham. Kidju says this showed her a blueprint for how to make a deeper impact. Quote, to me, the social worker who was trying and what felt like failing to address this major issue for students I was now presented with is, oh, these folks are not just applying a Band-Aid. This isn't just let's talk about your anxiety of your parents getting deported. DAE are stopping deportations, she says, and I was like, well, that's the thing I want to do. Kidju served as DAE district organizer, supporting building leaders in different schools before being elected president. Colleagues attribute her success to her background as a social worker, her skills as a listener, and her willingness to make space for others to be recognized while giving them tools to be successful. Perez says, I've known Simone for years and worked very closely with her, particularly during this campaign. She's a humble person who's not in it to make a name for herself. In the year since she took over, DAE membership has quadrupled to over 2,600 employees across the district. The union now represents a majority of DPS workers across the district and is taking its power in numbers back to the school board to fight for this meet and confer policy. After the fallout from the pay issue, the school board organized an ad hoc committee to discuss ways to prevent future miscommunication and other challenges between the board and workers. The process, intended to be a negotiation between DAE, the board, and administrators, broadened when district administrators included non-union workers, frustrating the DAE leadership. Four DAE members representing the union in the ad hoc committee walked out in protest at the start of a meeting on May 20th. Although there is overlap between the goals of the union and those of individual workers, Kidju says, the ad hoc committee has stalled progress on enacting a meaningful policy, saying, the board has created a narrative that the idea of meet and confer with union recognition is somehow excluding other workers. We understand our job as an employee representative organization to have the broadest representation of voices possible. We recognize there is a clear mistrust and gap of communication between individual workers and management. That is still true. That was apparent through that classified pay issue. It has been conflated into the same issue, he continues, and it's not. A possible path is they could bifurcate the process. We should deepen the policy that exists for individual workers to be able to have better communication about their working conditions between management, but that is different from an organization of workers being able to sit down with management and negotiate on working and learning conditions. Bettina Umstead, chair of the Durham School Board, says the board and DAE have been in deep partnership for years. She says she hopes that, despite the recent dissolution of trust, the two organizations can continue to collaborate on what's best for schools going forward. Umstead says, we know they have a growing membership that's touching these buildings across Durham Public Schools and connecting folks with the ability to connect with each other and help us grow and be better as a district. That's a vital partnership and relationship that we have, and we want to make sure we keep and strengthen it. And then, how do we also make sure we're looking at something everyone feels they have some connection to? But the trust that once existed between the board and DAE is seriously frayed. Natalie Bayer, a longtime board member, is clear-eyed about the damage the payroll crisis did to this relationship. Mistakes with people's checks are unforgivable, says Beyer. It was worse to govern through than the pandemic for me because there was no easy way to fix it and no clarity about what money we had to fix it with, and we had no CFO. It was a nightmare that kept going, and we felt responsible for all of them and the mistakes that were made by our staff. Meeting DAE's request for a meet and confer policy is one way DPS leaders could begin to repair relationships in the aftermath of that nightmare. But after 5 meetings so far, the union and school board still have yet to agree on the terms of such a policy. Kidju said in a rally in front of the administrative building on May 28th, "We often hear our leaders say that Durham is a union town. This moment tests that proposition. We call upon the school district and the Board of Education to stand on the right side of history and recognize our union as a legitimate employee representative organization with a meet and confer policy." DAE could have more allies in leadership come this fall. Wendell Tabb, a longtime drama teacher at DPS's Hillside High, who retired in 2022, and Joy Harrell, an educator and arts instructor whose husband, Malcolm Goff, previously served in DAE leadership, will join the school board. Former DAE president Michelle Burton and former school board chair Mike Lee will join the board of county commissioners. And DPS is searching for a new superintendent. Whoever fills the position will face a tough task of building back burned bridges and realigning DPS, DAE, the school board, and the county commissioners as a united front facing a common adversary, the Republican-led General Assembly, which last year passed legislation to route more than $4 billion away from public schools and into private schools via vouchers over the next decade. Kidju says there's a public school and public institution issue of being underfunded and then having people in leadership positions who don't have the resources they need to be good leaders. She acknowledges that administrators like Mubenga and Lesur made mistakes, but it's, quote, hard to be the superintendent and CFO of a public school district in North Carolina with massive underfunding and deeply impacted schools. The underfunding from the state for public education has been a very deliberate attack for a long time. On June 10th, the budget vote was the last item on the county commissioner's agenda. Lane, finance director, stepped to the podium to explain that between the county's contributions and funds remaining from the American Rescue Plan Act, the school board was getting its $27 million. Durham County Commissioner Heidi Carter, who served on the school board for 12 years before elected to county commission in 2016 and who's serving her final term, said the budget reached 98% of the school board request. The vote was not yet official, but the writing was on the wall. Months of advocacy from teachers, staff, parents, and others had succeeded. The audience in the county meeting chambers erupted in applause, but not everyone in the chamber was celebrating. When it came time to vote, veteran commissioner Brenda Howerton was the lone dissenter. She expressed concerns about the long-term sustainability of an increasing amount of the county's budget going to education and keeping DPS financially accountable after recent mismanagement. Howerton said her duty as a commissioner meant she had to consider the impact of a 4.65 cent tax increase on all county citizens, not just those in the education system. Howerton said, as a commissioner, I've learned to force tough conversations regarding systems accountability, said Howerton, who is in her last term after losing her reelection in March. Quote, this proposed increase on top of the increase during the previous years deserves more reasonable discussion related to accountability. The honoring and supporting of teachers, administrators, and classified workers is worthy of that kind of consideration. It's also worth noting the impact of tax increases on the most vulnerable citizen. It's my contention that property tax increases by both city and county during the same period is too much to ask our citizens. Her comments received applause, even from DAE members. She was right. The challenges facing the county and public school system were far from over. Without a clear source to increase revenues, the current method of supplementing DPS budget with county funding at this scale is not a viable plan year after year. But that was a problem for another day. That night, once the vote became official, the folks who had worked tirelessly to advocate for stability within the public schools were overjoyed. Kidju could not contain her own jubilation, even as she prepared herself for the next fight. Quote, "The union work we've done together this year has already transformed Durham for the better. This is only the beginning. This victory will serve as an example for years to come, not just in Durham, but all over North Carolina and the South. We did this." Durham Child Care Center prepares to close amid loss of federal stabilization grants, is our next article. Stephanie Smith's nearly 8-year run as a home child care provider in Durham is coming to an end, just as the child care stabilization grants that came from the American Rescue Plan Act expire. The veteran with more than 20 years of experience says she can no longer afford to keep the doors open due to rising expenses and state and federal child care subsidies that have not kept pace with the cost of doing business. So, Smith made the tough decision to close the doors to her Kids Rising into Success Child Care Center, which she opened in 2016. The center has one student left and will close for good on June 30th, which is already past us, almost. A big issue for Smith has been a chronic health condition that requires frequent doctor's visits. As a 4-star rated child care facility, Smith said she must have a highly qualified assistant with a 4-year degree in early child care education to fill in when she isn't there. She says North Carolina is really a stickler for education right now. There's a belief that education equals quality, and that's not the case. I believe that experience equals quality, and there's a fine line between education and experience and what quality means. North Carolina has focused so much on the education piece that a lot of great teachers with 30 years of experience but lacking the education are leaving this industry. Smith could not afford to hire an assistant with a bachelor's degree at the hourly rate he or she would command. An assistant that Smith had before the pandemic quit to take a better paying job with a major retailer, she said. "I'd have to pay them $15 an hour or more, and I could not afford that. I'm in a boat where I don't want to increase my tuition because parents aren't able to afford to pay the parent fee." Counties set child care subsidies based on family size, income, and other measures. Parents must pay the difference between what child care centers charge and the subsidy they receive. Newsline has previously reported the state will soon spend the last of $1.3 billion in federal grant money to support child care providers made through the pandemic. The money allowed some providers to increase staff pay, but when the federal money runs out, some centers will be forced to raise fees on families or close. Smith did raise tuition on two occasions. The parents' portion of child care jumped from $75 a month to as much as $230 a month for some families. And she said, "When I increased tuition, I lost students. If I increase it anymore, I won't gain any students, so it's better for me to find another job in child care consulting or child care advocacy." Smith said she even waived parents' fees to make tuition more affordable to parents struggling to stay afloat. And she said, what's happening is their parent fees increased, so they were struggling to pay their parent fee. I waived several parent fees, which put me behind on my bills. Her decision to close her child care center comes as child care advocates are vigorously lobbying state lawmakers to make a $300 million emergency appropriation to help keep child care centers open and teachers in classrooms. It also comes as the Republican-led House and Senate joust over state budget legislation. Both chambers are proposing to allocate roughly $135 million for grants that will no longer be provided by the federal government starting next month. Advocates, however, have said that $135 million is not enough to keep centers open and teachers in classrooms long term. They planned a rally for yesterday, to demand that lawmakers stay in Raleigh until they fully fund child care. Reverend Rob Stevens, NC Repairers of the Breach Organizing Committee Coordinator, said during a rally in Raleigh earlier this month, there needs to be a moral outcry. The fact that the Republican leadership willing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on vouchers for private schools that discriminate and are hesitating on passing funds for 100,000 zero to five-year-olds is evidence of a radical misalignment of values. As Newsline reported Tuesday, Senator Ralph Hayes, a Spruce Pine Republican and Senate Budget Committee co-chairman, said the $136 million in the Senate budget for child care stabilization grants is a stopgap measure meant to give legislators time to come up with a long-term solution. Meanwhile, Governor Roy Cooper's budget proposal calls for $200 million for child care stabilization grants. Cooper said in a statement, "A lack of access to child care is preventing parents from entering the workforce." Meanwhile, Republican legislators plan to spend $625 million on taxpayer-funded private school vouchers. We must address the upcoming funding cliff and invest in early childhood education and child care. A recent report from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation, in partnership with the NC Chamber Foundation and NC Child, found that insufficient child care costs North Carolina about $5.5 billion each year. The report, titled How Child Care Impacts North Carolina's Workforce Productivity and the State's Economy, found North Carolina employers lose over $4 billion each year due to job disruptions and turnover related to child care, and the state loses another $1.4 billion in tax revenue. Meredith Archie, president of the NC Chamber Foundation, said, "The health of North Carolina's economy is directly tied to the strength of its workforce. This survey shows our state is not realizing its potential when it comes to both families and economic competitiveness. Affordable, quality child care supports working parents on the job, allows businesses to recruit and retain talent, and helps North Carolina children develop skills for success in school and life." A survey conducted by the researchers showed 35% of parents who experienced disruptions to their employment in the past year reported leaving the workforce as a direct result of issues with child care. It also showed that 15% of working parents are planning to leave employment over the next 12 months. Newsline's Lynn Bonner reported in April that a North Carolina Child Care Resource and Referral Council survey found 88% of child care providers will need to increase parent fees when the federal money runs out. 40% said they would have to raise parent fees immediately. About half said they would lose administrative and teaching staff, and about two-thirds said they would have trouble hiring new employees with comparable experience in education. Nearly one-third of the programs surveyed said they would have to close within a year. That's equivalent to more than 1,500 programs and close to 92,000 child care and early education slots. Now, as you know, I believe you know, the Indy Week has under new leadership and has broadened its article base from simply staff writers to other publications that partner with Indy Week, and we print those articles, and this is another one of them from Lisa Sorg from Inside Climate News, entitled "Effort to Save a Historic Water Tower Put Lead in Chatham County Town's Soil." Pitted with rust, an empty water tower looms over this old mill village. In its short shadow rests an organic community garden, where overripe tomatoes dangle from dying vines and pepper plants droop, yellowed and parched. It's peak growing season, but the garden gates are locked. This is the most visible sign of an unintended consequence of an attempt to save the water tower and designate it as a historic landmark. Parts of Bynum, North Carolina, include the community garden, are now contaminated with the hexavalent chromium and lead. Last month, a company contracted by Chatham County began using power tools to clean the tower in preparation for repainting it. Even though the tower's age meant its old paint likely contained lead, and test results the county received in December detected both lead and hexavalent chromium, the county's contract with Bowles Restoration did not call for shrouding the tower to capture the flakes, nor did it mandate dampening the structure to keep the dust down. Instead, the contract merely called for tarps at the bottom of the tower, which is what Bowles workers did, according to residents who witnessed the work. When a breeze blew from the north and northeast that afternoon, it sent tiny shards of contaminated particles into the community garden and the neighborhood. Jania McBrien, who lives just 50 feet from the water tower and was downwind that day, said, "I saw a cloud of dust. There was no advance notice this was happening." Lead is a neurotoxic substance. Chronic exposures can permanently damage the brain and neurological system in children who are especially vulnerable because they spend time outdoors and often put their hands in their mouths. Adults with high levels of lead in their blood can suffer from brain, kidney, heart, and reproductive disorders. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has established screening levels for soil and dust, thresholds that, if met or exceeded, merit further investigation. However, EPA emphasizes there is no safe level of lead exposures. Soil is a frequently overlooked driver of such exposure, and climate change is expected to make the situation worse as floods spread contaminants. When she saw the dust, McBrien said she immediately called Chatham County officials, who shut down the operations within a half hour. Shortly afterward, they tested areas of that garden for lead and hexavalent chromium. Bowles representatives did not respond to several phone messages left on the company's voicemail. County spokesperson Kara Lusk told Inside Climate News that Bowles canceled its contract June 11th, 3 days before it was scheduled to expire. On May 30th, 10 days after the incident, Chatham County manager Dan LaMontagne sent a partial summary of test results to a Bynum resident, who then posted the announcement to the neighborhood's listserv. LaMontagne wrote that a mixture of samples collected from the raised beds and pots at the community garden contained levels of hexavalent chromium, also known as chromium 6, 35 parts per million. He has instructed residents not to enter the garden or the tower area until, quote, all work is completed at the site as determined by the county. What Lamontagne did not say is that hexavalent chromium is a known carcinogen. Inhaling it can cause kidney and liver damage and increase the risk of lung, nasal, and sinus cancer, according to studies of exposed workers. Ingesting this chromium in soil can cause gastrointestinal problems, including ulcers. It's also associated with anemia, and long-term exposure can harm the male reproductive system. Now, the state has not established acceptable levels of hexavalent chromium in garden soil specifically. The levels found in the Bynum Community Garden were 116 times the threshold set by the state and federal government as the goal for residential soil cleanup. The metal found in coal ash is a byproduct of electroplating, textile dyes, and other industrial processes. It was often added to paint on bridges as a protective coating. One of the ways it can contaminate soil is if it's present in groundwater or surface water used for irrigation, according to the Duke University Superfund Center. Lusk said the county is conducting additional testing to determine possible sources of the hexavalent chromium. As for the lead, Lamontagne wrote in his email that its levels in a mixture of soil samples taken from the community garden fell below residential health goals. He didn't provide numbers to support that statement. The exact figures are important. EPA's recommended health screening levels for lead in residential soil vary depending on whether other sources could be present in the environment, like paint and lead-lined plumbing in older homes. In those situations, the recommended threshold is 100 parts per million. For areas without additional lead sources, the threshold is 200 parts per million. All the 40-plus homes in Bynum's Mill Village were built in the early to mid-1900s when lead paint was widely used. The EPA did not ban consumer use of lead-based paint until 1978. Lusk, the county spokesperson, told Inside Climate News that one of the community garden samples showed a lead level between 100 and 400 parts per million. With McBrien's permission, the county tested her private garden, which faces the tower. The results showed levels of lead at more than 1.5 times the threshold for areas with multiple potential sources of the metal. McBrien, a scientist, conducted her own sampling, including areas near the base of the water tower that she could access through the chain-link fence. She also tested the leaves of her broccoli plants, where dust from the tower had landed, and the bottom of her dog, Frankie's, paws after he came inside from the fenced-in backyard. There are no EPA cleanup standards for lead on these types of surfaces, but the results are still notable. The dust at the base of the tower was highly contaminated with lead, 20,000 micrograms per square foot, according to the results McBrien shared with Inside Climate News. A microgram, that's the unit of measurement for lead in dust samples, equals 1/1,000,000th of a gram. EPA's, quote, current hazard standards for lead dust on residential floors, for instance, 10 micrograms per square foot, a threshold the agency has proposed tightening to anything above zero. 10 micrograms per square foot. The particles on the broccoli leaves also contained very high levels of lead, over 3,000 micrograms per square foot. Now, with the exception of root vegetables, most plants don't absorb lead into their tissues. However, people can be exposed by eating unwashed fruits and vegetables. And if the amount of lead found on Frankie's paws had been tracked in and detected on McBrien's floors, the concentration would have been more like 60 times higher than the dust lead clearance levels, that point at which abatement is considered effective. Many Bynum residents say the county has not been transparent about the situation, more than a month after the incident. They still don't know precisely where the sampling was conducted, what the test results mean in layperson's term, or how to protect themselves and their children from exposure. The county has held no public meetings about the matter. No signs at the garden explain what happened or warn against eating the vegetables. On a recent weekend at a park that's adjacent to that property, a teenager practiced kicking a soccer ball, his dog by his side. County officials are communicating with residents via email, primarily through one or two people who in turn post the messages to the neighborhood listserv, but some residents don't subscribe to it. Dylan Wager, who learned about the issue through forwarded emails, says the county has not communicated directly to my household. He and his wife have a newborn baby and regularly walk the dogs near that tower and an adjacent field. Lusk, the county spokesperson, told Inside Climate News, quote, "As this issue is localized in a small geographic area, we have relied on our direct contacts and appreciate the assistance of those people in getting the word out to the community. The county pledges to keep them informed as we move through this process." The tower, no taller than a small silo, has defined the skyline of Bynum for more than 75 years. For more than half that time, it was owned by a cotton mill, which drew water from a pond fed by the Haw River, and as recently as the late 1970s, piped it to communal spigots. The county originally planned to tear down the tower, but residents asked for a reprieve. Susie Crate, who helped save the tower, said the county listened to us and said they would keep it if we could find a company that would encapsulate and paint it for the same amount they had to remove it. Crate, a retired environmental anthropologist, said the water tower is an essential part of the Bynum Historic District, an area encompassing the mill houses and other historical buildings. The community is close to placing the area on the National Historic Register. Removing this contributing structure, part of the skyline, would detract from Bynum's historic value, said Crate. It's critical for us to maintain the water tower. No one can imagine it not being there. Last year, several Bynum residents who had worked with the county on the effort asked a company, Southern Corrosion, for a cost estimate to remediate the tower. They received an estimate of $48,000, the same amount the county had budgeted to remove it. The company subsequently tested a paint chip from the surface of the tower and found it had contained lead and hexavalent chromium, said Crate. The county received these results on December 11th, said Lusk, the spokesperson. Crate said Southern Corrosion explained to her and Bynum native Martha Collins that would abate the lead using a water sander, and the dampened lead dust would trickle down the sides of the tank and collect in a skirt at the bottom. The contaminated material would then be taken off the site for proper lead disposal. But because of state procurement rules, Chatham County could not automatically hire Southern Corrosion. It put the job out for bids. Bowles Restoration won the bid of $42,000, according to county documents. The scope of work between Bowles and the county does not include language about lead abatement. After the tower surface had been cleaned, it was to be coated with a special type of paint to encapsulate any contaminants. The contract stipulates only the company will follow all federal and state laws and will indemnify the county for any harm that could occur as a result of the work. Lusk told Inside Climate News this work on the tank was not considered abatement. Through the listserv, county officials have said, quote, any further work on Bynum water tank will be done in accordance with appropriate state requirements. Wager, the resident with a newborn, said the county should test soil in a 500-foot radius from the tower and garden boundary, saying, the wind doesn't care about who owns what property. Contaminants may have spread in every direction. The State Division of Public Health has recommended that all impacted soil and plants from the community garden be removed, according to county emails. Until the tower is remediated and the contamination removed, the garden is closed. Katie Fanfani, whose family has raised vegetables at that garden since 2017, said something went really, really wrong. She had routinely brought her children, two children ages 6 years and 4 months, to the garden to show them how to grow food. For residents, the community garden represents a slower, more sustainable way of living that people here embrace. The Bynum garden was special, and now it's truly ruined, says Fanfani. It's a tragedy. Fanfani wants the county to pay for a new community garden space, but even then, she said, it won't feel quintessentially Bynum, like the general store, the weekly front porch music series, and local folk artist Clyde Jones, who uses a chainsaw to carve critters out of wood. It had that same spirit, she said at the garden. It can never be replaced. I have time now for a book review. Lindsay Stark book, Monsters We Have Made, which was just recently published, and it's will be an interview with her or an appearance at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on July 9th. July 9th at 5:30 p.m. at Flyleaf Books. And Veronica Cavas writes this review. In Gravity and Grace, a posthumous collection of Simone Weil's philosophical reflections, she observes, imaginary evil is romantic and varied. Real evil is gloomy, dull, and boring. Imaginary good is boring. Real good is always new, marvelous, intoxicating. Is this still the case today, or has the internet killed the romantic appeal of so-called evil monsters? This question is posed in Lindsay Stark's new novel, Monsters We Have Made. Stark, who is now based in Minnesota, graduated from UNC Chapel Hill and is the author of Noah's Wife. The novel begins in 2008 with hikers calling 9/11 after finding a teenage babysitter stabbed by 2 9-year-old girls in Durham's Eno River State Park. This haunting incident serves as a portal, propelling readers into the intricate web of emotions between Sylvia and Jack, two soulmates turned estranged by their 9-year-old daughter Faye's puzzling descent into violence. The true villain in this story is the King Man, a faceless figure who lures children into the forest towards his kingdom in the North Woods of Minnesota. He haunts, as Stark writes, quote, the dreams of parents flung across the country. The monster who emerged from the Fertile Crescent and stalked through shadows of the centuries, sliding through civilization after civilization, story after story, until he found us. In the present day, the Kingman, who is based on Slender Man and Susan Cooper's Boggart, can be found in numerous rabbit holes and chat forums. Following this Eno River State Park tragedy, more children attempt to murder adults who get in the way of their search for the Kingman. The narrative airlifts in and out of the stabbing's aftermath, and a new development 10 years later when 4-year-old Amelia is abandoned in a parked car in a Durham grocery store. Her parents are nowhere to be found, so the police take Amelia to her next of kin, Sylvia. In literary telenovela fashion, Sylvia and Jack are reunited to take care of Amelia and locate their distant daughter, Faye, who is also Amelia's mother. She is on a new quest to find the Kingman again. While this may sound borderline nightmarish, Monsters We Have Made is actually somehow a feel-good story. Even though the characters encounter difficult experiences in North Carolina, they also zoom around the state from coast to mountains in such a dreamy way. Sunny flashbacks amongst butterfly migrations and coppices reveal how sweet Sylvia's and Jack's lives were before the stabbing incident. Furthermore, Sylvia is a genuine bibliophile and hardcore romantic. In the second half of Monsters We Have Made, the narrative begins to feel as if the author is withholding information about Sylvia, when her loved ones, namely her Minnesota-based sister, abandon Sylvia during the hardest passage of her life following her daughter's juvenile indictment, an abandonment that is portrayed as justified. Is there something other characters are seeing about Sylvia that's obfuscated from the reader? And again, sometimes sisters just suck. Stark's deep love of language is evident. The characters choose their words carefully, and etymological breakdowns are seamlessly woven into the narrative. The role of stories is explored through freestanding references to historical and literary snapshots depicting vanishing children throughout time. The investigation into what makes a monster scary is explored in equal measure to what makes love scary. In fact, characters often choose to spend their time looking for a monster instead of rebuilding bonds with their loved ones. The darkest territory of the book is the shifting landscape of online manipulation. Monsters We Have Made has hit the bookshelves within months of the U.S. Surgeon General's call for warning labels on social media sites. Imaginary monsters may be romantic, but the online ones are a different story. I have enough time, I believe, to read most of an article about Chino Ghee, G-H-E-E. It's Super Empty's Song of the Week. Ryan Kalka writes, "Confidence is a powerful thing, one that tends to have a proportionate and self-reinforcing relationship with the amount of affirmation, or lack thereof, we receive from others. It makes sense when we see widely lauded artists move with swagger and self-assurance, and conversely when lesser-known acts seem occasionally unconvinced of their own talent and persona. As with anything in life, it's hard to sell a version that hasn't been, to at least some extent, validated already. And yet, over the past few years, that timeless dilemma hasn't seemed very difficult for Charlotte rapper Chino Ghee. Across multiple releases, from 2018's Child EP to 2022's To Whomever It Concerns to a host of singles and feature verses in between and after, it's true, the Brooklyn-born, Atlanta-raised former UNCC student has yet to experience the traditional markers of breakout success, though two songs from her last album, Bodega and Savoir Faire, come close. Still, aside from the technical prowess that's immediately apparent upon listening to her music, a flurry of intersecting, unpredictable cadences and smart, biting wordplay, what might stand out most about Ghee is the unflinching confidence that seems to emanate from her at all times. In listening to her rap or talk, as she does to rap portals in 2021, saying, "I've got the Midas touch right now, so whatever I touch next is bound to surpass anything I've done," one hears a sense of belief, so firm and resolute it's almost as if ordained by a higher power, and in her case, maybe it is. Chino is not a Christian rapper, but she is a rapper, nicknamed the Godchild, whose work is heavily informed by her Christian faith. So it's fitting that her return back to releasing music, her first time in 2 years, not counting a two-pack of freestyles last year, her return would bear not only her trademark confidence, but a title and theme and album art that speak overtly to where it comes from. And I mean really overtly. Across God Don't's 3.5 minutes, "God Don't Play About Me" is repeated no fewer than 11 times, primarily on two choruses. that bookend the song's one true verse. But more than a declaration of prophecy, the song is also a demonstration of raw skill, showcasing her deft ability to maneuver in different pockets. The song's transition from chorus to verse feels like the apprehensive moments coasting along the top curve of a roller coaster, Gee slowing the chorus down into a series of staccato stabs, even briefly stretching the effect into the verse before plunging into rapid-fire sequences of words so dense they almost become compound concoctions of their own. The accordion-like stretching and compressing effect is so reminiscent of UK rap that certain listeners may find themselves subconsciously hearing it delivered in the voice of Dave, Little Sims, or Central C. You'll have to add the thams and broves yourself. God Don't is predictably assertive, bold comeback single for an artist whose talent easily outstrips the recognition she's gotten to date. Rather than sound dejected, Chino Gee sounds as confident as ever. And for her, that's saying something. Now, as I always mention, Indie Week is available online for the most part, and most of these stories, though there is a print edition, are more up-to-date from the IndieWeek.com, where you can find them yourselves if you're interested. I'm skipping now, it's no more time to read two stories in my last folder from Indie Week. One is about LGBT-owned bars and gathering centers in Raleigh. And the other one is about another novel tracing a long aftershock of a college campus murder. I'm putting them back in my folder, and if there's time next broadcast, I will get to them for you. Well, I must say farewell then and indicate that the next issue will come out on July the 5th. I will record it on that Friday, July the 5th, and we'll see what the Indie Week has for us. John Federson will say so long now. The podcast will be available after the initial Friday release. Just look for Independent by the Indie Week at ncreadingservice.org. So long, and thank you for listening.